search and rescue operations underway after a powerful earthquake leaves thousands of people dead in Turkey and Syria. Another Palestinian falls victim to Israeli violence. The teenager dies of wounds after being shot by regime forces in the occupied West Bank. Also ahead, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledges to expand and intensify military drills and strengthen the country's war readiness posture. Welcome. Our top story this hour is a somber day in Turkey and Syria as the number of victims of an earthquake that jolted the two countries on Monday is now increasing by the hour. In Turkey, the death toll has topped to 3,400. Rescue crews are racing against time to find those who might have survived the natural disaster. The Turkish vice president says severe weather conditions are hindering the transfer of aid to the impacted regions. The 7.8 magnitude earthquake had its epicenter in southern Turkey. It also shook northern Syria, where rescue efforts are underway to find possible survivors. The fatalities of the catastrophe in the Arab country now stands at over 1,600. Hundreds more are injured there. The affected regions in the two countries have also witnessed dozens of major aftershocks. Let's cross over to Damascus, joined there by Mohammed Ali, our correspondent. Mohammed, what's the latest there with regards to the search and rescue efforts?
Yes, first of all, the death toll reached 1,600 people killed as a result of the earthquake. This is in both government-held areas and terrorist-held areas in Idlib and its surroundings. Search and rescue operations continue, however, and unfortunately, chances are decreasing for finding people alive under the rubble, now that it has been over a day and a half since the earthquake first hit those areas, especially in Aleppo and Latakia, and also with the lack of necessary equipment. And here I have to point out to what the head of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent said in a press conference just a while ago. He called for lifting economic sanctions on Syria so that necessary equipment, bulldozers, and all necessary needs required can reach here to the country so that they can actually do better job and their efforts would be more fruitful in rescuing the people. Also, what is important to say is that more humanitarian aid and assistance is coming to the country. Just today, there has been a flow of humanitarian assistance. There is an Iranian airplane loaded with 45 tons of assistance, mainly blankets, food, and medicine, arrived at Damascus International Airport. There will be two more Iranian airplanes arriving at Aleppo Airport and Latakia Airport, also two Iraqi airplanes. Oman said it will send assistance. Lebanon is sending teams to help the search and rescue. Also, an Algerian civil defense team made up of 110 persons arrived at Aleppo International Airport in order to help the Syrians in the search and the rescue operation. But all that is not enough. Sanctions should be lifted, at least in order to facilitate and increase the flow of humanitarian assistance to the people in need. The challenges the Syrian government is facing is providing shelter, perhaps, for those who become homeless because of the earthquake, because of the collapses that happened to tens of buildings in Aleppo and Latakia. tens of schools were turned into temporary shelter centers for those in need. However, because of the sanctions, because of the U.S. occupation in the northeast and all of that, there is no electricity in the country. It's extremely cold over here. So it's a very difficult situation inside Syria. We have to wait and see what will happen in the coming few hours. If we could hear any statements from Western countries that have imposed sanctions for years on Syria, we have to wait and see.
Mohammed, thank you for that. Mohammed Ali is our correspondent on the ground in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Now, staying with this developing news, Iran has sent its aid to Syria to support the victims of the deadly earthquake that hit the Arab country on Monday. An Iranian plane carrying aid touched down at Damascus International Airport in the early hours of Tuesday. The aircraft was carrying 45 tons of supplies. Tehran had earlier expressed its readiness to send relief aid to both Turkey and Syria. Other countries have also vowed to assist. Russia says 300 military personnel deployed to Syria are already helping with the clear-up effort. And the European Union says its member states have mobilized over 10 search and rescue teams for Turkey. The UN says its staff are now on the ground in Turkey and Syria to assess the needs and provide assistance.
The United Nations is mobilizing to support the emergency response, and so let's work together in solidarity to assist all those hit by this disaster, many of whom were already in dire need of humanitarian aid. It is time for all of us to show the same solidarity that I've witnessed in the area in relation to refugees fleeing one of the most difficult conflicts of our time. Another clock turned, the so-called doomsday clock.
Pledges of assistance have also been made by other countries across Europe, Asia, West Asia, as well as North America. Turkey says 45 countries have so far offered help with search and rescue efforts. The World Health Organization says it has activated its network of emergency medical teams. They will deliver essential care to the injured and the most vulnerable victims. A young Palestinian teenager wounded in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank has succumbed to his injuries. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, 17-year-old Hamza Amjad Al-Azghar was shot in the face by Israeli forces in Nablus. The incident happened during a raid by the regime's forces on a neighborhood east of the city. Hamas resistance movement has reacted to the deadly raid, warning the regime over persistence in its crimes. Israeli forces also killed five Palestinians in the West Bank city of Jericho on Monday. The regime has intensified its crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, killing 44 people in just over a month. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has wrapped up his week-long visit to Latin American countries. During the meetings, the top Iranian diplomat discussed ways to enhance Tehran's cooperation with countries such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdullahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During the meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdullahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla. Both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdullahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdullahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned unlawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdullahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year.
The Latin American visit by Iran's foreign minister highlights the need for countries like Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and even Brazil to form an alliance to stand against U.S. hegemony and unilateralism. Latin American countries are not the only ones, but even many African nations are eager to enhance ties with the East, namely Iran, Russia, and China.
Amir Abdullahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony.
Turning elsewhere now, Saudi Arabia has launched fresh artillery attacks on Yemen's border areas, killing one person. The attacks on the northwestern province of Sa'da also left at least two others injured. Saudi Arabia and its allies frequently hit Yemen with deadly shelling and airstrikes. Since 2015, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in the Saudi-led war. An embargo by the coalition has also pushed Yemen into what the United Nations has described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to expand military drills and beef up the country's war readiness posture. Kim was speaking at a meeting of the Central Military Commission of the ruling Workers' Party. The officials discussed major military and political tasks for this year. North Korea is expected to stage a military parade on Wednesday to mark the founding anniversary of its armed forces. Tensions have been rising in the Korean Peninsula in recent months. Last week, Pyongyang condemned the drills by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. North Korea says the war games have reached, quote, an extreme red line and threatened to turn the Korean Peninsula into a war zone. This as Washington has vowed to deploy more aircraft carriers and long-range bombers to the region to counter North Korea's weapons development. Elsewhere, Russia says it has opened a probe into Kiev's alleged use of chemical weapons during recent battles in eastern Ukraine. Moscow says pro-Russia forces in the Donetsk region reported the chemical attacks by drones in the towns of Soledar and Bakhmut. Russia says its forces fell ill and showed symptoms of poisoning. Kiev has dismissed the allegation, in turn accusing Russia of using banned ammunition. Since the start of the war between the two neighbors nearly a year ago, Russia has repeatedly warned that Ukraine might be preparing to use non-conventional weapons. Ukraine and its Western allies have rejected the allegations as part of a plot to stage false flag attacks. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General has warned that the Russia-Ukraine conflict could escalate into what he called a wider war. Antonio Guterres' war in Ukraine tops the list of priorities for 2023. He warned that the prospects for peace keep diminishing, while the chances of further bloodshed keep growing. The UN chief stressed that the world is not sleepwalking into a bigger conflict, but doing so with its eyes wide open. The war in Ukraine has escalated tensions between Russia and the West to unprecedented levels in recent decades. The West, led by the US, has been providing tens of billions of dollars worth of military aid for Ukraine while slapping tough sanctions on Russia. Moscow has been warning that the West's increasing involvement could take the war to dangerous new levels. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Thank you. insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iranian foreign policy with Deputy Foreign Minister Dr. Ali Bagheri-Kani. But first, this brief analysis.
As we enter 2023, the rapidly emerging new multipolar world and the historic failure of the JCPOA process are two realities that are significantly affecting Iranian foreign policy. At the same time, Iran's ever-increasing hard and soft power, rooted in the efforts and jihad of its own population, are enhancing Iran's power and strategic options in this emerging new world. Even though international organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS, have existed for many years, it's the addition of the Islamic Republic of Iran to these organizations that many analysts consider to be an important sign of this new emerging multipolar world and the end of U.S. global hegemony. There was a time in the beginning of the 21st century when the US and Europe believed they could create regime change in countries like Iran and Russia, install strategically compliant governments in these countries, and in this way, neutralize these two Eurasian powers as potential rivals. But these attempts failed on numerous occasions, and we are now witnessing a world order emerging, wherein Iran is joining international fora such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS, even after the failed JCPOA process proved that Western economic sanctions against Iran will never be lifted as agreed to by the US and EU, though Iran has complied fully with its commitments. The US will never allow countries such as Iran, Russia, or China to rise and develop peacefully unless they accept becoming its strategic and economic vassals. The world and Iran itself has changed significantly in recent years, making obsolete the assumptions of the late 20th century that Iran needs to have some sort of sanctions relief from the West in order to grow its economy. Iran is experiencing significant economic growth for the first time since the global COVID outbreak. It is selling millions of barrels of oil on a daily basis, and according to the IMF, is now the largest economy in West Asia, slightly larger in size than the Australian economy, ahead of Saudi Arabia, and twice as large as Turkey's economy based on GDP purchasing power parity. All this while still being sanctioned by the US and Europe to a greater degree than when the JCPOA process began so many years ago. The world will experience significant political, security, economic, and technological change in the decade ahead, and it will be characterized by America's desperate and violent attempts to maintain whatever it can of its rapidly declining hegemony. All of these factors will significantly affect all countries, including Iran, but unlike some other countries, Iran will use these new circumstances to increase its fundamental goal of maintaining strategic independence and continuously increasing its hard and soft power as it has in the last 40 plus years. Iran's most important power is its message and its manifest example of not being an oppressive power on the world stage and never accepting oppression from other powers. A message and power rooted in the Islam of the Ahlul Bayt and something very appealing to all liberated human beings from all corners of the world. Iran's successful model of very significant independent social growth and development, while resisting US hegemony, serves as the model for many countries as they seek to find their place in the new emerging world order. A soft power that Iran attained through decades of sacrifice and jihad of its people. A power that very few others in the world can lay claim to.
Deputy Foreign Minister Dr. Bagheri-Kani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. I know your schedule is very busy. You've taken the time to come sit with us and talk about these issues. Thank you so much. And this is a good opportunity for us to discuss issues related to Iran's foreign policy. Of course, you're in the middle of all these events, so your analysis, your evaluations, your opinions are highly valued in this regard. And I would like to, with your permission, begin our discussion with this idea, this concept that's been mentioned a lot recently by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, by various experts from around the world. This idea that we are entering into a new global order, that the old order with American unipolarity, with American hegemony, is coming to an end, that we're moving towards multipolarity, that there are different countries and powers in the world who will now have the capability of exerting their power and their influence in the world in a way that was not the case previously. So if you could please give us your analysis, your evaluation, your understanding of this idea that we are now entering into a new global order.
In the name of God, I send greetings, and I hope that this program, within the framework of the main mission of the media to explain different points of view, can be transparent, direct, and successful, and be a platform for the elucidation of developments and phenomena, so that everyone can be realistic and, even with different perspectives, be able to realistically see the path ahead and make smart and conscious choices. In response to your question, I would suggest that order is always based on a balance. After World War II, the victorious states in the war created a balance by themselves. Although they wielded dissimilar levels of power, a balance was created between them, and an order was established based on this tacit agreement between them, within the framework of the understanding between them, leading to the formation of comprehensive and political mechanisms such as the United Nations and the Security Council, with the veto power of these countries. Also, due to the advantages of the Americans exercised in various fields, especially in the economy, mechanisms such as the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund were set up in the global arena. But the role and influence that the Western countries, especially the Americans, had in these mechanisms was much more significant compared to others. In my opinion, the important point on which this order was based was the issue of the power of the parties that formed this order. Because the nature of their power was based on their military capabilities that had come to the fore during the war, and later they gradually became nuclear powers, and after the Americans, the others gradually became nuclear powers, and particularly these five countries became the five nuclear powers that could create a very serious and effective deterrence, they were the ones that formed that power. But over time, both the internal changes made by these powers as well as the environmental transformations witnessed in global developments underline this order to the extent that after the collapse of the former Soviet Union, one could say that the order was shaken, like it was hit by an earthquake. Because finally, a superpower that had stood against the Western world as the Soviet Union, with all its dimensions of territorial prowess and geographical power given its control over a vast territory right into the heart of Europe, not to mention other elements of power, was practically put aside, despite all the power it exercised, and a new world was born. Other environmental developments were also effective. Issues such as the Persian Gulf War and Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in the wake of that Persian Gulf War also plays a role in these transformations. At that time, the Americans claimed a unipolar system in the world. Perhaps, according to many experts and theorists, this claim was not an exaggerated one because of the power gap between the U.S. and the rest of the world, which was a significant gap in various respects, economically, scientifically, politically, in the media, militarily, you name it. Well, the Americans had the belief that they could shape this order based on their own centrality. Actually, they exerted a lot of effort to this end. But since there is little time, I won't take the time to talk about this. But another thing happened along this path, and that was the Islamic Revolution. Although the Islamic Revolution took place in a country in the West Asian region, the content and quality dimensions of the Islamic Revolution presented a new way of thinking and a new model in the design of the international system. And that was not relying on any major powers. This was a limited framework within the framework of the Islamic Revolution. Confronting the Islamic Revolution was very seriously and effectively pursued from the very beginning by various powers, especially the Western ones. And the 8-year war imposed on the Iranian nation by Saddam took place within the same framework. After some time, the Americans themselves realized that although this order is their wish and expectation, the regional and international conditions do not allow it to proceed as smoothly as they had wished it to proceed, because many of the elements of their power were challenged in important areas of the world. The Islamic Revolution brought a serious challenge to the main power pillars of the Americans in our region, which is the Zionist aggressor and occupying regime. This regime, which always, after its illegitimate birth, which has always desired expansion and did this in practice, encroached on other lands and occupied them. It would not even respect international mechanisms, but it was forced to withdraw from Lebanon for the first time. And the essence of the will that caused the Zionists to surrender, its source was the Islamic Revolution. And the whole world understood that such a power has been formed here. The vast international support that was given, even to Israel's crimes, would not keep this regime safe in that framework, and they had to retreat in many areas. Later, they retreated from Gaza. In any case, this framework had been disrupted. Americans' frame of mind for a unipolar global order. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were small tests and trials to determine what the framework of the international order would be like. Even if you remember, some people in Russia, like Yeltsin and his companions, expressed their desire to join the Western Bloc and even expressed their desire to join NATO. But none of that worked. It remained as an expression of desire or an outward and verbal welcome. The important point was that two important changes occurred in the international arena. One was the decline of the power elements of the Western world, especially the U.S. When you look at this issue from a futures perspective, you can see that this decline is becoming very tangible. I recently saw in an assessment by an American institution that, for example, by the year 2050, the world's first and second economies are not expected to be the U.S. The first and second in the world will be two Asian countries, China and India. The third will be the U.S. There will be a root cause and background for this to be materialized by 2050. That background is that which we are talking about. So this decline is an objective reality. A similar issue happened in Europe. The blow given by Trump to the cohesion and connection of the two sides of the Atlantic, the discussions that were held for them to contribute their share in NATO and so on, this created a gap in the Western world, and this matter was effective in the strategic weakening of the elements of Western power. But an issue that was and still is an important matter for the Western world, especially the United States, is the question of Russia's independence-oriented power. After the collapse, they had a plan to limit this power or to employ it within their own framework. One side is the Western view. On the opposite side, in any case, the powers that have both civilizational and historical roots and are emerging powers in today's terms. In many countries, it cannot be said that they are emerging powers. You may suppose that South Africa is an example of an emerging power, but after all, Russia is a power with a historical background. Or take China, for example. It is a power that has the elements of history. It is not like they achieved a power structure overnight or at one point very quickly. The point that these powers arrived at is that in order to secure their own interests in the foreseeable future, they must create their own distance from the Western world in a meaningful way, that is, seek independence. Accordingly, they looked for new power mechanisms. They realized that multilateralism cannot be realized in the framework of the UN Security Council or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or other mechanisms. My understanding is that the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS, which later developed into BRICS Plus, emerged from this mindset. We should create powerful international multilateral mechanisms to prevent the monopoly and bullying and domineering of Westerners, especially the Americans, without causing the collapse of existing mechanisms by using the capacity of these international authorities. For this reason, you can see, for example, that the elements of power that exist now in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization or BRICS Plus have caused them to match up with new players in a new fashion. After a predictable period of time, I imagine that they can see themselves as an element of power that the Western side, especially the Americans, should pay serious attention to. Perhaps one of the reasons we can posit as the root cause of the war in Ukraine is this issue, which can create a divide between this multilateralism against the Western world and weaken it. And both the creation of disunity and its weakness are in favor of the continuation of the management model that was developed by the Westerners after World War II and persists even today. In any case, they are looking to develop and improve these elements of power based on the axes that are at their disposal within the framework of their interests. So we're now faced with a world that is in transition and must reach a new order, because after all, it is correct that the world has gone through various orders in the past. Every balance comes to an order. But this order may be an unstable one, because we believe that based on our religious teachings, an order can only be stable and bring peace, prosperity, and happiness to mankind only if it is based on justice. But this does not mean that other orders are not formed. Other orders can be formed. For example, suppose someone steals from someone else. For a while, he will benefit from what he has stolen. He may steal some money from someone, get himself something to eat, buy a piece of land, but this will not be sustainable. After all, there are factors that repair or correct that violation. Based on this, we will reach an order, a new order, but it will not necessarily be a justice-oriented. But one of the important elements that we can now discern as the outlook of multilateralism in the world for this new order is the justice-oriented approach. Now, how much it will be realized is another matter to discuss. For example, in our dealings with the Chinese and the Russians, we see that they hold a similar approach in their take on this new order. They always stress a justice-oriented order based on the views, ideas, and power of independent countries. Such an approach creates a stable backbone for the new order. But allow me to emphasize once again, how much this has been achieved in practice is debatable because it depends on many other factors. What we say is this: we have a transition period to reach a new order, and one side is the Western world led by the U.S., and on the other side is multilateralism centered on several countries with different elements of economic, demographic, military, scientific, and media power, such as Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, Iran, and India. These countries are striving to coordinate between themselves so that they can present the elements of their national powers in the world arena with synergy. Because the elements of power, if they fail to work together, will not be able to withstand the existing order imposed by the West and disrupt this imposed order so that we enter the stage of establishing a new world order. At this stage, I think that the Islamic Republic of Iran has played a prominent role and can even be a more decisive player in the future in several ways. One of them is from the Islamic Republic of Iran's approach and insight. The Islamic Republic of Iran's approach, which is based on the Islamic Revolution mindset, is people-centered. The governance model it has presented is religious democracy. I think this is a very important point. We see people-centeredness in all manifestations and matters of the view of the Islamic Revolution, whether inside the Islamic Republic or outside. For example, the element of resistance that manifests the regional view of the Islamic Republic of Iran is basically people-based. It means that it is the people who can shape this, direct it, continue, and improve it. In parentheses, it should be noted that the art of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic is that this view, especially the model of resistance, which is based on the people, is not in opposition to the governments. Rather, it is synergistic with governments, except in Palestine, where we believe that the Zionist regime is an aggressor and the resistance current is rightly against this regime. But in other places, you can see that the resistance movement is helpful to and synergistic with the government. And this, in my opinion, is one of the secrets of the success of the Islamic Republic model. Because the Western side and the foreigners cannot create a distance between the government and the popular movement of resistance, trying to represent resistance as an illegitimate current. Look, for example, how Hezbollah is operating in Lebanon. What is Jaish al-Shaabi in Syria? What are the Popular Mobilization Forces, PMF, doing in Iraq? But the point is that it has created a new element of power. The effort that the Western world is making, if you take time to pay attention, you will see that these popular elements of power are aimed at providing national interests for these countries and help governments to ensure national security, preserve territorial integrity, and ensure the well-being and comfort of the people. In order to weaken them, because they cannot destroy them, they label them as terrorist movements. They give these groups a negative international image to prevent them from promoting their current state of power. So, what were we discussing? We were saying that the Islamic Republic can play a role in the transition period. Yes. In what areas? One, in the field of official interaction with other governments in the framework of multilateralism. Our 25-year cooperation plan with the Chinese government is one of its approaches, with the Russian government in the framework of a 20-year long-term cooperation plan. One of its manifestations is the discussion of the New World Order. With India, we're following the same long-term strategic approach. With other powers in the Americas, with Venezuela, we will finalize this 20-year long-term framework. We have the same plan with Brazil, especially in the new era, when a new government has come to power in this country. This is the governmental domain. In the intellectual domain of the Islamic Revolution, the extension of the Islamic Revolution in our own region, which is the resistance front, I mean, as an element of undeniable power, not just the issue of resistance, but as a model of governance. Because you see, some people want to falsely introduce resistance as only a preventive model, an effective force that can stand against occupation, aggression, and domination, who has succeeded in this and it keeps withstanding. It expelled Israel from Lebanon. In Palestine, it was able to grow as a serious power element against the continuation of Zionist hegemony and a main obstacle to the continuation of the Zionist regime's hegemony is this current of internal resistance in Palestine. In Iraq and Syria, it showed in practice that it can preserve territorial integrity and consolidate national sovereignty. It can also destroy the terrorist movement supported by foreigners, because now it is true that we have terrorist groupings both in Iraq and Syria, but the appearance that they wanted was to present themselves as a sovereign. And practically, this resistance current showed that no, it will not allow them to continue their plan. So this is their preventive dimension. In addition to this preventive aspect, resistance current has a creative aspect. That is, it does not just prevent, but it can also create. In Lebanon, Hezbollah plays a fundamental role in governance and in establishing order, in providing people's well-being and comfort. The whole world is witness. In the same way, in Syria and Iraq, these currents in various fields, whether in the form of parties or other popular currents, were able to show their creative aspects with their presence in the government and the consolidation and cohesion in the government. So this is an element of strength that can be developed and will not be limited to our region. They want to weaken this in our region, so this current does not permeate into other communities. so that if people in other regions follow suit, they would think it would be too costly. This is the plan of Westerners and foreigners for the resistance movement. Allow me to sum up my remarks here by saying that the Islamic Republic of Iran has both a vision and a long-term plan for the new international order and has adopted measures to be able to present a new approach with the cooperation of other powers in the form of multilateralism in the international scene, an approach that guarantees the establishment of order with a justice-oriented perspective and horizon in the world.
Well,
that's very interesting, Doctor, because it seems to me that you mentioned things like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS Plus, you know, things that are now happening in the world that are manifestations of this new order, which you described very, very nicely and with detail. But I want to stay a little bit with the idea that Iran itself has changed also in this period. That Iran, the Iran that we have today, is not the Iran of 20, 30 years ago. So when we had the revolution, we saw that this, in a way, what you were mentioning is that a lot of these countries are not new powers. They are old powers that are retaking their position that they had historically in terms of human civilization, particularly those countries that are in Asia. But I want to stick with Iran because, yes, of course, China has always been a large country, a big powerful country in terms of human history. We have Russia as the, in a way, inheritor of the Soviet Union and that history which is close to us. But if we look at Iran, both in terms of hard power and real power, but and also the soft power and the ideological power, Iran, if it takes its natural position, is a powerful country in the world on the same level as many other countries. Some might say, okay, it doesn't have the population of China, it doesn't have the size of Russia, but we see in history that a lot of countries, Britain, Holland, Portugal, that might be smaller, much smaller than Iran is now, and much less powerful in terms of population and hard power, were able to, you know, have a very significant effect on global affairs. So I want to stick with this idea that Iran is also one of these countries, because you talked about the changes that are happening being related to real changes of power, that there's a real decline of U.S. power and there's a real increase of power of other countries. So if you could please, let's delve a little deeper, because people might say that we're just trying to do, you know, we're just saying something, but it's based on reality. What, in your opinion, in your analysis, are the real factors of the hard, real power that Iran has, and of course the soft power that you were talking about? Because we talked about the idea that Iran doesn't go to Venezuela and say to, for example, Venezuela that, you know, you have to be Iranian, be Iranian. America does that. It goes to countries and says, become American. So Iran is talks about this, and the Supreme Leader has talked about this many times, that it's the same thing that Imam Ali talked about, which is we don't oppress and we don't accept oppression, this idea which is an Islamic concept. And this seems to me is the most revolutionary thing you can say in the world, in a world that's based on an oppressor and people accepting oppression. Here's Iran saying, be yourself, don't accept oppression and don't oppress.
به نکته به نظرم مهمی حضرت عالی اشاره کردید. یا کنید.
You raised an important point. Look, from both hard and soft elements of power, Iran, the Islamic Revolution, and the Islamic Republic have characteristics that, in my opinion, are in objective states. That is, they can be touched and observed. In the field of hard power, the elements of Iran's power are abundant, from its location and land area in the world, to its resources, to its human resources, to many other areas. On the other hand, it is an aspect of soft power that is aimed at the people of Iran and their beliefs, which originated from the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. The important point, in my opinion, is that the soft power of the Islamic Revolution for other nations is not that they become Iranian, but that they be true to themselves. I remember a while ago, a European journalist asked me, "What do you want from us Europeans? What do you expect of us to be satisfied, for example?" I told him that we don't expect anything more from you, that you should only look after your own interests. If Europe pursues its own interests, we would have no problem with Europe, and Europe would have no problem with us. The problem is where you pursue the interests of other parties and create problems for yourselves and others. We have a religious belief that, for example, it is also mentioned in the Quran, that, for example, don't be afraid of poverty because of having offspring. When you have a child, the one who gives the child, who is God, also provides its sustenance. It is the same in the national format. When God Almighty gives identity to a nation, He also gives them power. But sometimes, or many times, the nations do not realize the elements of their power due to various reasons, including weakness, being weakened by the dominating powers. In my opinion, one of Imam Khomeini's miracles in the Islamic Revolution was the identification and recognition of the elements of the power of the Iranian nation. And more important than that was the transformation of the elements of power into real authority. And this placed us in very difficult circumstances at the beginning of the war imposed by Saddam against the Iranian people, where we even needed to import the most obvious defense tools, such as barbed wire from abroad. They didn't give it to us because we were banned. We were forced into the war in this environment, and we finished the war with ballistic missile capability while we were under sanctions. How is this possible? What kind of soft power is this that without receiving help from outside, even though you were sanctioned, you not only resisted and protected yourself, but you could transcend? Well, this soft power is strong. This soft power was given to other nations after the war, and you can see the result in Palestine. You can see it in Lebanon. You can see it in Syria. You can see it in Iraq. You can see it in Yemen. For example, in Syria and Iraq, there were two governments with two armies against the terrorists. But the governments and the armies of those two countries themselves admit that what defeated the terrorists was the popular resistance movement, which is the soft power of the Islamic Revolution that can empower the people, the masses. The interesting thing is that the people's movement that is formed in Iraq seeks to secure Iraq's national interests in Syria. It seeks national interests in Syria. In Lebanon, it seeks national interests in Lebanon. The resistance, which is a single identity, does not have this conflict at all. And this is the virtuosity of the Islamic Revolution. That is, this is the inclusiveness of the Islamic Revolution, which is a global revolution. As you rightly pointed out, so did the U.S. and the Soviet Union. When it wanted to develop, when it went to Europe, it implemented its own system. That's why when the foundations of governance in Moscow became weak, all of them collapsed at once, because they were artificial, imposed, not belonging to those countries, they were not people-based, but the thinking of the Islamic Revolution is not like that. Therefore, what I want to say is that the correct point that you mentioned, that the Islamic Republic of Iran has power elements that can play an effective, strategic, and influential role in the new order, with these power elements in the new order, including in the framework of multilateralism, is a fact. This is not just a claim. During the war in Syria, the actor who created the space for Russia to act there was the Islamic Republic. That is, this comprehensiveness of soft power imbues the model of the Islamic Republic, which can streamline a popular movement alongside the world power and the national government of that country towards a goal, which is national independence, maintaining territorial integrity, providing national interests, and providing the welfare and comfort of the people of that country. You rarely see a framework and mechanism in the world that can create such synergy. So this is the comprehensiveness of the view, model, and soft power of the Islamic Revolution, which can help shape a new and stable order in the form of multilateralism.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.